Thanks for listening to the Henry Center podcast. We seek to bridge the gap between the academy and the church by cultivating resources and communities that advance Christian wisdom. If you'd like to learn more about the Henry Center, please visit our website at henrycenter.org. There you can find hundreds of articles, videos, and publications which promote theological understanding. The best way to stay connected with us is to subscribe to our newsletter, though you can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. If you're able, we'd love to see you at one of our upcoming events, hosted at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. Our public lectures feature scholars and pastors offering careful reflection on a range of biblical, theological, and ecclesial topics. We hope you enjoy today's discussion.
Well, thank you, Dr. Jip. It really is a privilege and a pleasure to be here. I confess being a bit nervous. I mean, it's my alma mater, and I wasn't sure how I would feel walking on the campus. And I think I probably will cry a little bit later. Yeah, it is nice to be here. The Waybright Center wasn't here when I was a student here. Neither was President Waybright, but that's okay. But yes, I'm coming as a pastor scholar, a pastor who's had academic sensibilities for a long time, and by God's grace was able to do the doctorate and had a chance to teach for many years, often as an adjunct, but then full time. But I am going to weave in a few personal anecdotes, and I hope you don't mind as I get into this topic. You know, years ago, when I was a younger pastor, I attended a denominational conference and went out to lunch with a friend, and this friend was always, he always would cut up, and he's still pretty comedic, at least he thinks of himself as such. And when we would leave the site of the conference, he would snatch off my name tag, you know, and I was going to take it off anyway, but he'd snatch it off so we could, you know, kind of be incognito as we were going out for lunch. And when he was chatty this time as we were in a restaurant, and the server and he, you know, they were interacting. And at some point, some attendees from the conference came in, and she got a little crestfallen, and they had their name tags on. And she knew that there was this church group in town, and she was not all that excited about serving the Christians because she knew she wouldn't get tipped well. Now, in my own experiences, it had me wondering if Christians were bad tippers. So I decided, when I was working on that First Peter commentary, to do just a little bit of research. And some people from my alma mater, Cornell University, they had researched tipping, and they discovered this. It says, results indicated that Jews and those with no religion tipped more than Christians and members of other religions, but the vast majority of Christians tipped at or above the normative 15% of bill size. That's when 15% was normative. And it sounds like the Christians I knew kind of do exactly what you had to do, and not much more. So Christians might not be poor tippers, but we aren't as generous as others, according to that study. Yet Christians had this reputation for being stingy in some circles. So if I ask you right now to think of a metaphor for the church, and sometimes when I'm talking to church groups, I'll ask them to respond out loud, but I don't want to take that much time right now. But for the most part, I get these beautiful metaphors like family, and community, and bride, words that we see in scripture or we imagine such. In earlier days, I would ask, and you'd hear army. I think that one's coming back up again. But anyway, for the most part, we Christians have a favorable view of ourselves, and maybe that view is aspirational, if not actualized. But many people in the USA do not share our favorable view of ourselves. A few years ago, a Christianity Today article argued started out with this line: evangelicals are the only religious group in the United States that has not developed a better reputation over the past few years. And Americans have become less likely to know an evangelical, more so than any other faith tradition. I found that interesting, especially people who have the evangel, the good news, would like to be known, and they said statistically less likely to be known. Another study went on to say only 21% of non-Christian people have a positive perception of the local church, a fifth. Half of non-Christian Americans don't trust local pastors. When I started out as a pastor, We had a little bit more trust than that, I think. And I suspect we could say that Christians have a negative reputation in the world because we do so much good that people are simply jealous. I mean, after all, some people hated Jesus, so they will naturally hate us. You know, maybe there's some truth to that, but at the same time, it seemed the Lord hoped that we would be agents of positive change in the world while winning people over to the Lord. We would not be purposefully alienating people, but instead be extraordinarily loving, kind, compassionate, and self-sacrificial. As God's peculiar people, as Peter would put it, we would be shining lights in darkness. We would be salt and light. Christianity in the USA and perhaps throughout the world can have a stronger witness, more fruitful influence, and increasingly more Christ-like reputation if we recover what humility is meant to be. Humility is not a self-help strategy, although some might see it that way. And even though Jesus says that whoever wants to be great must be your servant, humility is not meant to be a stepping stone to some worldly sort of greatness. Humility is actually countercultural. So my discussion of humility and power today has three main movements or themes: humility as a Christian identity marker, humility and the power of marginalized people, and humility and shepherding. My first point is that humility should be a Christian identity marker. A German scholar, Eve Marie Becker, says that in early Christianity, humility was regarded as a virtue that was unknown in the pagan world, and thus as a Christian identity marker. And Becker goes as far to say that the Apostle Paul invented humility. I mean, he appears to be the first in the ancient world to give positive meaning to tapenaphrosune. We'll talk about that word a little bit later. What is humility? I'm defining it this way. Humility is a way of life rooted in submission to God and is demonstrated in actions that foster mutuality rather than competition. So I see humility as fundamentally a biblical virtue because it starts out with us yielding to God and it moves us to be peacemakers. Humility is not popular, at least not in the U.S. and not even among Christians. We tend to think of humility as weakness and passivity. I mean, that's often people's first kind of image of what humility means. You know, sort of like if I show up in a space, and I'm a pretty even-tempered sort of a person, at least I think most people who know me would say that. So if I talk about things like race and class and power, some of the stuff I'm going to talk about today, and I'll say it in a way that, you know, is acceptable to them, then, oh, he must be humble. Like, the bar is just don't be a jerk. I think that that's not the bar, you know. But we do often think of humility as passivity and weakness. Jane Fulcher, she writes, while humility had a central place in early Christian theology and practice, it has generally been marginalized by the modern Western world and in contemporary Christian life. She's one of several authors who note that Scottish philosopher David Hume dismissed humility as a monkish virtue. German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche referred to humility as Christian slave morality that demonized the pursuit of power and self-fulfillment. There's also a stream within Christianity that distorts humility by equating it with humiliation and smallness. Humility does not mean viewing ourselves as insignificant or as some lowly, wiggly worms. It doesn't require us to think that we're junk. No, we are fearfully and wonderfully made, all of us, and to protect we're fearfully and wonderfully made, and all of humanity, being made in the image of God, does not need to denigrate itself and call that humility. But while we don't engage in the self-denigration, neither do we behave arrogantly or vaingloriously. Vainglorious, that's not a word we throw around much, but it's that old King James word from kenodoxia, empty glory, vainglory. Rebecca Conan Dyke DeYoung, she wrote a book about vainglory and says, the prideful desire superiority and the vainglorious desire the show of superiority, although these can easily be entangled in practice. I'm saying that humility rejects the pursuit of superiority, real or imagined. So it would be good at some point, maybe not right now because we just don't have the time, but to imagine what it might look like for increasing numbers of Christians to actually practice humility. What things would come to mind? Vulnerability, better listening, more empathy, more respect for the weak and marginalized? I mean, surely humility can't mean pointing fingers and doubling down on self-righteousness, snark, and arrogance. In other words, it can't look like much of what I see on Christian Twitter X. So let's keep in mind the possibilities that humility invites when we think about ministry in our schools, in our churches, and in other spaces. If humility can be a Christian identity marker, then I hope it can be a way of life and not something we turn on and turn off depending upon the situation. So that brings me to another point. I'm trying to argue that humility is not meant to be episodic, but is meant to be a way of life. To protect our psyches as well as our bodies, we do develop a version of humility, I think, in which we don't yield very much ground to others, but we don't want to be called arrogant. So what I'm saying, maybe rather than trying to either absolve ourselves of pride or present a glittering image of success to the world, we would do better to reject society's hierarchical competitive culture and examine why we feel the need for any self-promotion. Embracing humility does not begin with worries about how impressed people are with me. I don't need to measure or calculate my humility as if I'm being graded on some sort of scale. We don't need to prove how humble we are. It's not really a contest. Humility grows from my relationship with God and governs how I interact with other people. So cultivating humility means pursuing intimacy with God and compassionately serving others without worrying about my brand or stressing over my popularity. Before I shift to my second main theme, I want to note part of the reason why I say humility starts as intimacy with God. I want to briefly consider the example of Moses found in Numbers 12, 1 through 16. I did want to read it. I think I can do that. If it looks like I'm going to take too long to read passages, I'll skip them because I know y'all have it memorized. Most of the Bible, right? Anyway, Numbers 12. While they were at Hazeroth, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had indeed married a Cushite woman. And they said, "Has the Lord spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?" And the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was very humble, more so than anyone else on the face of the earth. Suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, "Come out, you three, to the tent of meeting." So the three of them came out. Then the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the entrance of the tent and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forward. And he said, "Hear my words. When there are prophets among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to them in visions. I speak to them in dreams. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. With him I speak face to face, clearly, not in riddles. And he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?" And the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, and he departed. When the cloud went away from over the tent, Miriam's skin had become diseased, as white as snow. And Aaron turned toward Miriam and saw that she was diseased. Then Aaron said to Moses, "Oh, my Lord, do not punish us for a sin that we have so foolishly committed. Do not let her be like one stillborn whose flesh is half consumed when it comes out of its mother's womb." And Moses cried to the Lord, saying, "Oh God, please heal her." But the Lord said to Moses, "If her father had but spit in her face, would she not bear her shame for 7 days? Let her be shut out of the camp for 7 days, and after that she may be brought in again." So Miriam was shut out of the camp for 7 days, and the people did not set out on the march until Miriam had been brought in again. After that, the people set out from Hazeroth and camped in the wilderness of Paran. Well, I won't go through the whole passage, although I did want you to see the story in context, but it's that verse 3 that stands out, right? It's sort of squeezed in there about Moses' humility. And commentators typically interpret the representation of Moses as humble or lowly or gentle as referring primarily to meekness in relationship with others. In fact, one scholar goes as far as to assert that Numbers 12:3 is a counter to, as he puts it, an accusation of arrogance on Moses' part made in verse 2. Yet Miriam and Aaron never actually accuse Moses of arrogance, at least not that we see explicitly. We only get details of their complaint directed toward God about how God speaks through Moses, who just married an African woman. Now, the Numbers 12 context pictures Miriam and Aaron as complaining about Moses' role as God's spokesperson. The two other scholars, they notice the nature of Miriam's complaint, and they point out, the thing being questioned by Aaron and Miriam is Moses' status, not his ego. And I found their argument convincing. It appears that the lowliness or the humility of Moses describes his connection to God more than his interpersonal connection with his siblings or even the rest of the people of Israel. Intimacy with God shows up as submission to God. And in the Numbers 11 and 12 context, what marks Moses as humble seems to be the way he's intimate with God. I mean, that phrase that God says he speaks to him face to face, or literally mouth to mouth. Humility starts as submission to God, then it moves out to make an impact on others, to make a positive impact on others. It's like what Aquinas writes, but humility considered as a special virtue regards chiefly the subjection of man to God, for whose sake he humbles himself by subjecting himself to others. As I transition to the notion of humility and the power of marginalized people, I want to note how the refrain of Proverbs 3:34 paints a picture of humility as a way of life. The refrain gets repeated or echoed in the Apocrypha, the New Testament, later in the Apostolic Fathers. He mocks, this is the NIV version, he mocks proud mockers, but shows favor to the humble and oppressed. Sirach then, for example, picks up this notion and says it this way, my child, perform your tasks with humility. Then you will be loved more than a giver of gifts. Excuse me. The greater you are, the more you must humble yourself, so you will find favor in the sight of the Lord. Then later in the New Testament, but God gives all the more grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And then also, and all of you must clothe yourselves with humility in your dealings with one another, for God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Then later in 1 Clement, let our children receive the instruction that is in Christ. Let them learn how strong humility is. I actually love that phrase, how strong humility is. Before God, what pure love is able to accomplish before God, how the fear of him is good and great and saves all those who live in it in holiness with a pure mind. Boldness and arrogance and audacity are for those who are cursed by God, but graciousness and humility and gentleness are with those who are blessed by God. Humility, like love, is a pervasive theme throughout the scripture, the Apocrypha, the New Testament, later Christian writings, because it's such a critical aspect of our faith. Look, Christianity in the United States is a polarized mess right now, and I believe that humility could help us get back on track. When I think about this concept, I think about some adults in my life. I think about my own father, even. And when we were at this church we attended when I was a kid, I'm going to say a little bit more about that church later, but we were in church all day. Some of you are not used to this, but I'm old, and this is how it used to be. So we'd be in Sunday school for an hour and a half, morning worship for about 3 hours, afternoon service for a couple of hours, then the evening service was also whenever people felt like going home. So that would be at least a couple of hours. And we would get there for the afternoon, evening services on early, which was really on time, but we were there before everybody else. So we would sit in the car often waiting for the doors to be open, and only deacons could have keys, but my father got a key because he was always there on time, so they trusted him to have a key. But I think about how my father served in that church and how he was helpful, how he would stay around to see if anybody needed a ride home who had come on public transportation, and how he just would assist in different ways. And my father was a very bright man, but without much formal education. He had to leave college to go fight in World War II and then took care of his mother. Brilliant person when it came to mathematics. You know, setting up and assisting in those kind of ways might seem like an insignificant matter, but humility is reflected in the way that leaders interact and serve others. So over several decades, I've been in a lot of ministry. I've been in doing, you know, church planting where we meet in non-traditional spaces. And over the years, with this kind of mental image of my father, I would find myself grabbing a broom, folding chairs, wrapping up the cords, and driving people home, because I actually wanted to simply embody humility and not see it as a strategy to gain somebody's favor. Well, I've been trying to touch on the notion of humility as a Christian identity marker, but I'm transitioning to talk about humility and the power of marginalized people. because this affects the way we do our education as well. When I was a student at Cornell, this is now many years ago, I started attending an African-American church near downtown Ithaca. And one day I'm coming back to campus, or coming back to my dorm room actually, and working my way up North Campus and going through the student union. And I look and I see a person in custodial garb buffing the floors, and recognized him as this prominent deacon in our church in the city. And I thought, wow, I didn't know he even worked up here. And I thought about all the ways that we students, many of us African-American students who attended, looked up to him, a very vocal person, a leader in the church, just a, you know, gave off this very godly image. But then I thought about all the students with the power and privilege who go to an Ivy League school, walking right past the custodian because, you know, we don't notice those people. And my point is, humility allows us to learn that lessons of godliness come from those most likely to be overlooked. This relates to what I wrote about in Might from the Margins. My thesis was based on 1 Corinthians chapter 1 there. I'm not going to read the passage for the sake of time, but like I said, y'all got that memorized too. But it's about how God takes what's apparently lowly in the world to shame the wise. I think that our ability to embrace humility as a way of life is largely related to how willing we are to accept that God often comes to us in the unimpressive. And we can receive lessons from the unimpressive, whoever or whatever that might be, when we have submitted ourselves to God. So let me try to say this more clearly. The lowly of the world are often our best teachers of faithfulness and Christlikeness. And the more I submit or yield to God, the more I am able to learn from those who are on the margins of society. That's part of what humility entails. The places where I received my formal Christian education accepted the Christian faith of white people of European descent. That's the standard. The faith of marginalized people was respected only to the degree to which it affirms white superiority. But what picture of Christianity is most like that of Christ? I've got a couple of block quotes for you. These I actually will read. The first is from Professor Albert Raboteau. He says, African-American Christianity has continuously confronted the nation with troubling questions about American exceptionalism. Perhaps the most troubling was this. If Christ came as the suffering servant, who resembled him more, the master or the slave? Suffering slave Christianity stood as a prophetic condemnation of America's obsession with power, status, and possessions. African-American Christians perceived in American exceptionalism a dangerous tendency to turn the nation into an idol and Christianity into a clan religion. Divine election brings not preeminence, elevation, and glory, but as black Christians know all too well, humiliation, suffering, and rejection. Chosenness, as reflected in the life of Jesus, led to a cross. The lives of his disciples have been signed with that cross. To be chosen in this perspective means joining company not with the powerful and the rich, but with those who suffer, the outcast, the poor, and the despised. Professor Raboteau's observations are not unlike those of Frederick Douglass that you hear from time to time. He says, what I have said respecting and against religion, I mean strictly to apply to the slaveholding religion of this land, and with no possible reference to Christianity proper. For between the Christianity of this land and the Christianity of Christ, I recognize the widest possible difference, so wide that to receive the one as good, pure, and holy is of necessity to reject the other as bad, corrupt, and wicked. To be the friend of the one is of necessity to be the enemy of the other. I love the pure, peaceable, and impartial Christianity of Christ. I therefore hate the corrupt, slave-holding, woman-whipping, cradle-plundering, partial, and hypocritical Christianity of this land. Now, Douglass could see that the Christianity practiced by so many in America was not the way of Jesus described in the scriptures. Yet, I dare say that for many Christians today, and I think often in evangelical circles, the great American heroes of the faith are people who justified slavery, who owned slaves themselves, and who weren't always sure what to make of the souls of black folks. Did we have souls? Could we be saved? Some of the theological giants weren't even sure. Now, I'm saying that marginalized Christians are the disinherited and possess unique power to demonstrate the way of Christ. And I take that word disinherited from the poet, mystic, and theologian Howard Thurman. You may know his book, Jesus and the Disinherited, a classic, written all the way back in 1949 and still relevant. And Thurman centers in his words those whose backs are against the wall. That's his term for what I'm calling marginalized believers. Here's more of what he wrote in context. The solution which Jesus found for himself and for Israel as they faced the hostility of the Greco-Roman world becomes the word and the work of redemption for all the cast down people in every generation and in every age. The basic fact is that Christianity, as it was born in the mind of this Jewish teacher and thinker, appears as a technique of survival for the oppressed. That it became, through the intervening years, a religion of the powerful and dominant, used sometimes as an instrument of oppression, must not tempt us into believing that it was thus in the mind and life of Jesus. We leaders could miss out on some of what it means to be a follower of Jesus when we fail to learn from the people who tend to get overlooked. I'm going to say a little bit more about that in a few minutes. I'm going to take us quickly to just a picture of what some of this might, some implications for this, at least when we see in the New Testament. I'm in Paul territory, so I'm very nervous, Dr. Jim, so because this is not my specialty, but I'm thinking about Philippians, right? And the way we're set up for Philippians is by looking at what Luke says, right? And so in chapter 16 there, and you may be familiar with that Macedonian call, come over and help us, and Paul shifts the mission and they go on over to Macedonia. And Luke says they stop in Philippi, and he describes it as a leading city. Protas, he says, it's a first city, a leading city, and a colony of Rome. So we're set up to know that there's these special privileges and how important it is. Some commentators who write about the letter, they acknowledge that the letter seems to, at least to some degree, interact with imperial sensibilities, such as Paul's mention of the praetorium, him touching on the notion of citizenship with these rare verbs, politeuistai in 127, politeuma in 320. He talks about this bending the knee and hailing Jesus as kurios, like the way people would do with Caesar, how members of Caesar's household even send greetings at the end. So there's some, you know, Romanesque things in that letter, of course. And then Euodia and Syntyche, two women that he addresses in chapter 4, likely the names of enslaved people. So what I'm imagining here is a community of free and enslaved people who are coming together because of Jesus. And then to have Paul say, and what he writes, I'm not going to read all of it, but that line, do nothing from selfish ambition or empty conceit, but in humility, consider others better than yourselves. Now, depending on where you are in this social hierarchy, that's good news, because I've been working and literally slaving to help this powerful person, but that powerful person has to look at me in a whole new way. That's what I'm asking for. I mean, it's what our friend Michael Gorman, a New Testament scholar, would say is Paul's master story there, because he shifts right in verse 5, right? Let this mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, and then we get the beautiful Christ hymn. It's like Galatians 3:28, where the hierarchical distinctions don't seem to matter in Christ. When I was a kid, I told you about the little church I attended. Felt like I had to work for my salvation in that church. I'm not here to dump on any denomination, but they had a oneness theology. You had to be baptized to be a Christian. And you had to have certain experiences that would mark you as a Christian. And I'm a kid, you know, I was an athlete. I played sports and I'm a musician. But I also was kind of bookish. I liked science and math. So I had this very rational image of what was supposed to happen in the church, and it wasn't happening, and somehow I wasn't fitting in. And the message I was getting is that you gotta get your act together for God to save you. So I had to sort of prove something to God. And then at that same time, because I was born not that long after the Brown versus Board of Education decision to desegregate schools, I was bused to a white neighborhood in Queens, New York. I'm from New York. And every New Yorker is going to tell you at some point that they're from New York. And you know, Douglaston is the neighborhood where John McEnroe, the tennis great, practiced. He practiced at the Douglaston Country Club. My neighborhood didn't have a country club, just so you know. So I had, you know, black friends, black kids rode on the school bus, and then I'm at a school with white kids. I'm in these two different worlds, which I didn't even think of as a kid, didn't know how to analyze. I just knew that we kids on the bus were always seen as the discipline problems, and that we weren't going to do as well in class. I think my teachers were generally shocked that I did well in school. And then by the time I got here, years later, I had some difficult interchanges, and I was wrestling with myself like how much to talk about it, but I'm going to mention one of them. I remember being in a class and responding to a question from the professor, and his response back to me, he put on this like mock patois of somebody from the South with no education, like you might imagine a black person in a, you know, in a 1930s movie talking. And he looked like, blah, 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 blah. I'm not even gonna say what he said. So I'm sitting there saying, what the heck? I'm like, I'm from New York, I don't talk like this, but why would you even feel like you could do this? And why isn't it bothering anybody else, you know, which is also what was going on. That agitated me, and when I went to go get my midterm exam, he curtly said, I don't have your exam. He said, I gave him back. I happened to work security at the time, so when I was on my shift, I said, I know what happened. They put it in the wrong box. Those boxes were in Rolfing down, I don't know if there's, I'm not Rolfing, in Olson. I mean, they're probably still down there. Anyway, so not my test, because I found that. I went in there, found my test in somebody else's mailbox, which is exactly what I thought. And I had a really high grade, like 98 or something. So I said, that has to be a good grade. So I saw him later, and he said, genuinely shocked, you got the highest grade in the class. Like, it really seemed to bother him that I was doing well. And don't get me started on a few other professors, but I'm not going to drop them. I was like praying about this. Like, I don't know how much I'm going to talk about. But a different professor who gave me a really hard time when I asked questions from my African-American perspective, especially in an ethics class, he didn't want to talk about it, put me on the spot in the classroom, and then, you know, proceeded to win the Faculty of the Year award at the end. I said, okay, that's telling me a lot of stuff here. You know, when I passed my oral defense years later, and the dean comes in to congratulate you, you know, that warm feeling when you, some of you here who have PhDs, you know that. It's just this emotion comes over you. They call you doctor for the first time, and I'm in tears. And the dean says, oh, you're the first African-American to earn the PhD in biblical studies here. And I'm saying, and I remember thinking, first? I'm still at that place where I've been the first or the only so much of my life, often in Christian circles, but not only. And I'm telling you all this to say that all along my journey, I needed to know that God loved me, because early on, the church didn't make that clear. The theological world around me didn't always treat me as if God loved me. And I could tell you way too many stories about how evangelicalism has caused pain for people of color. That's for another time. But I do sometimes lament the way I was treated and the irony that now that I'm over 60, I get invited to be part of boards, committees, and conferences. Thanks be to God, I live long enough for some people to actually want to hear something I have to say. When George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis, a city where I served as a pastor for a while, a lot of black Christians, including me, were asked to give interviews, and suddenly white people wanted to hear from us, only some of us, and only for a time. And since Esau Macaulay can't be everywhere all at once, sometimes we OGs get a call. So I got one last point to make. It's about humility and shepherding. So I'm telling you a lot of my background to say how, for me, when I think about theological education, I am thinking about my own story, but not just my story in a biblical context. I left to go plant a church in Brooklyn, New York, and that's a whole nother story. But during the time, there was no money, so I had to teach school again, so I was teaching math and chemistry. We now euphemistically call this being bivocational. Back then, I just called it hustling to make a living. So, but the headmaster at the school acknowledged that I had a flock. That was the way he put it, that I had a flock at the school. And I kind of like that, because I do see teaching as shepherding. I think of leading as shepherding. So I want to remind us all of Scripture's call for humility, but also kind of connect it to this notion of leading and teaching. In June of 68, Servius Sulpicius Galba became emperor of Rome after the death of Nero, and it didn't really go well for him. He managed to frustrate, alienate, and infuriate soldiers as well as political leaders. According to Suetonius, Galba was cruel and greedy, and a lot of things he did, I don't have time to elaborate on. He didn't have any children, so he selected an heir that nobody liked, particularly not the soldiers, And then he reneged on a promise to give bonus pay to the troops. So having alienated the military, Gabo was doomed. And then on the morning of January 15th, now notice he becomes emperor in June, here it's January, just 7 months later, he and his successor enter the forum and were attacked by soldiers who hacked him to pieces and decapitated his successor. Josephus briefly recounts Galba's reign as well as his death, and he notes that the soldiers took Galba to be, and here's this word that we mentioned earlier, tapenafrasune. That's the word that Paul uses for humility. Peter uses it as well. Josephus, however, uses it in the sense of small-minded. Some translations will say pusillanimous, timid, lacking resolve. Josephus's use of that word compared to that of Paul and Peter reflect this generally negative connotation of the concept in the Greco-Roman world. New Testament scholar Reinhard Feldmeier, observing the way that both Josephus and Epictetus employed tapenafrasune, concludes, it has a negative meaning that lies, depending on the context, somewhere between sycophancy and pusillanimity, servility and shabbiness. But ironically, and I think it is ironic, Peter and Paul both reinterpret the word here for us, so they redefine it in some ways to describe what, for what Josephus used it for, a pitiful leader, they use for somebody who's actually more of an ideal leader. That instead of small-mindedness, weakness, and timidity, we embrace a notion of self-sacrifice, gentleness, and fearless advocacy on behalf of the vulnerable. So rather than tapenafrasune describing insecurities and weaknesses, it describes humility necessary for guiding people on the path of shalom or wholeness. I was going to spend some time talking about this First Peter passage. I won't. I'll just say briefly a few things, and then I'll start to wrap up here. I like the passage a lot in that 1 Peter 5, 1 through 6, because it hits at a lot of things born from my experience as well as my own relationship, well, my relationship with God, my experience as a pastor, and things that I study. Peter says this, I will read a little bit. Now as an elder myself and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as one who shares in the glory to be revealed, I exhort the elders among you to tend the flock of God that is in your charge, exercising the oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you do it, not for sordid gain, but eagerly. Do not lord it over those in your charge, but be examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will win the crown of glory that never fades away. In the same way, you who are younger must be subject to the elders, and all of you must clothe yourselves with humility in your dealings with one another, for God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that he may exalt you in due time. There's much in there that's rich to me, and I go back to that passage quite a bit. But I think the thing I want to center on is that notion of being an example to the flock. Because teaching isn't just about information. And you all know this, especially those who are teaching. It's also about inspiration and maybe some emulation. There's who we are and not just what we know. And in some ways, Peter is saying that. And I think, you know, we can't help but to see in this, no matter who you think wrote First Peter, I'm not going down that road right now, but you can't help but to think of the epilogue to John's gospel. And I think it's intentional to see this so-called restoration of Peter and what Jesus says for him to do. What does he say? Feed my sheep. Feed my sheep. And here's Peter, now an old man. He says, I'm an old man myself. And I'm telling you, protect the flock. Watch over them. Episkopos, right? To be the one who watches over. And set an example. Leadership is shepherding. And in that shepherding, it fosters a collaboration, not a hierarchy. I'll end up with some reflections from theologian Willie James Jennings in his powerful book, After Whiteness, An Education in Belonging. He discusses an essay by Belgian theologian Edward Schillebeek, and it's entitled Secular Criticism of Christian Obedience and the Christian Reaction to That Criticism. Schillebeek sought to reconcile a vision of humanity's grandeur and the biblical notion of humility. So Jennings comments, reconciling the magnanimous man and the Christian man, reconciling inherent human grandeur and godly humility, was a dilemma for Christianity. So Jennings goes on from there to argue that Western Christianity created a concept of what an educated person should look like. And he says this: white self-sufficient masculinity is the quintessential image of an educated person, an image deeply embedded in the collective psyche of Western education and theological education, flexible enough to capture and persuade any and all persons so formed to yield to it. It floats through our curricular imaginations, our pedagogical practice, and the ecologies of our academic institutions. Jennings says that our theological formation that serves this image of white self-sufficient masculinity will, quote, lock students in a formation that will take much more than it will give. I feel like I can not only appreciate that, I actually can feel it. I think a path forward for us is this path of humility, because I believe all of us who teach, who preach, and otherwise guide people should take humility seriously. So I'm arguing that if we promote humility as a Christian identity marker, I dare say that there may be many other things that people think of when they hear the word Christian, but I'm saying that humility should be one of the first things that comes to mind. And I know that some people feel like that scholars are especially guilty of not exhibiting humility. That's anecdotal, but it's worth thinking about. Humility is a Christian identity marker and enables all of us to respect the spiritual power of those marginalized by worldly power. I mentioned I lived in D.C. I know how people like to be around those with power, but they want to be near the politicians and they ignore the people who clean the floors, work the elevators, open the doors, serve them food, and otherwise work in the shadows. Many of those people are African-American people who attend the black churches in D.C. but are invisible to the people who are striving to be important. Humility also marks us as shepherds. It guides us in the formative work we do as Christian leaders. And we leaders model collaboration rather than competition. All right, I'm wrapping up. When I was heading to school here back in the 80s, the school advertised with this tagline, "Come study with the men who wrote the books." And the picture was a stack of books written by white men, and perhaps that relates to what Jennings was getting at. I will say, however, that TED seems to have come a long way, and I recall when Bruce Fields was voted in as the first full-time African-American faculty member. It was the year I graduated from here. I don't know the African-American Bible or theology professors you've had in the 35 years since that time, but the day that Bruce got voted in, I ran into Scott McKnight. I was doing my rounds in security, and I said to him, "I heard we have our first black faculty member, full-time faculty member." And without skipping a beat, Scott said, "Dennis, you'll be next." I was encouraged, but I didn't believe him. And I remember thinking, maybe TEDS could grow its own black biblical scholars. That was the language I was using, grow its own. Now, I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus, but I went to the president at the time, who was not Dr. Wainwright, and I went to him and I said, "I wonder if we could grow our own black professors." And I said, I'm kind of thinking I'd like to do the PhD. Do you think there's any way I could get money to do that?" And he said, "Well, you got to get in first." I'm like, "Okay." So I applied, I got in, and then I got the letter that said I had to pay a $200 deposit. And I said, "Shoot, I don't have $200. So I called him back and I said, "I'm about to make this step." I said, "Do you think I could get some kind of scholarship to help me?" He said, "I wish I could have recorded that conversation because nobody's going to believe me. I've told this story for like 35 years, only to a certain few people though." And he said, "I don't think black people want to come all the way out here to the suburbs to study, so no." I was like, dude. So I started a PhD program at Fordham in the Bronx while I was still in New York, and then I moved to DC and started all over again at the Catholic University of America, and I got on the alumni board. So while I was on the alumni board, I'd come out to campus a few times, and by then Dr. Wainwright was president and he was talking about some of the things. We met, I think it was Dr. Hunter at the time was dean, and we talked about some things, and they always give a report to the alumni board. And at some point, Dr. Wainwright says, "Our African-American students would love to see more black faculty." He said, "Maybe we should grow our own." I'm like, "Grow our own?" I mean, it was years after. I said, But I do want to say, the journey has been a little tough. There were times when, I got mistaken for the hotel help at SBL, Society of Biblical Literature, wearing my tie and my name tag, but people assumed I worked for the hotel. I guess why they assumed. But I do want to end by simply honoring some of the folks who saw me while I was here and helped me not to give up. One is the late Jim Spear. He had his quirks and and challenges, but he saw me, and I was his graduate assistant, or TA, whatever we called it back then. The late Bruce Fields, who did encourage me to keep on going and to do that PhD. The late Grant Osborne, who I would choke up in tears thinking about how encouraging he was to me. And then Scott McKnight, who's still alive, and Scott's the one who opened the door for me to get some things published and to help people to know that I actually exist. My friends, just remember this. God opposes the proud, but shows favor to the humble. God bless you. Thanks.